the earthquake. When I did get down to Soldovia, what they were really concerned with was the high tides in the spring and the fall. And when I was here, I can remember, so there was a little skiff, and some guys got in it and rowed through the cannery, like there was about a foot and a half or two foot of water in the cannery. I think maybe, I can't remember for sure, a foot and a half, maybe. But that illustrate people had sandbagged during and after the earthquake. They had sandbagged the boardwalk, so if when the tides did come, the boardwalk, if in case there was any wave action, the boardwalk would not be removed. You know, it would, and so the whole area was the boardwalk area was all sandbagged with weight to hold it in place. And I remember when that particular tide, which was not only was a high normal tide, but the wind was pushing it in. Certain directions of wind make a bigger tide. And at that time, a lot of people took pictures, and as I said, they took a canoe, and then they took a little skiff, and then took pictures of that to illustrate the to dramatically illustrate how just how far it had sunk and how what effect it had on the existing cannery operations.
Did it have any effect on your personal house?
I had a house on a barge, and I had purchased it in 62 and floated it up under the bridge and floated it in at high tide, and the tide came in surges here, and it did all the damage it did in the harbor was to break up the floats. It didn't really crush or sink any boats, but the surge was enough that it busted the floats loose from where they were. And but up the slough where I didn't notice any damage on my structure.
You mentioned the bridge. That was a drawbridge of some sort?
Not at that time. At that time it was I would describe it as an A-frame bridge. The two supporting structures and then that would be a good description of what it was, the bridge that existed.
So it was stationary, it didn't raise
it? No, it had taken the place of the one, the drawbridge in previous was when this cannery, the cannery property,
Seems we managed to pick a night when they're gonna do some dirt work here, huh?
I can't imagine where he's going with that. Who it is. Must be Hopkins. He's the only one that works this time. But, the drawbridge time was the time of when the sawmill was going. When I got here, the sawmill hadn't, in 1960, the sawmill was starting to fall apart.
Can you describe the sawmill at that point in time, the ruins of it or whatever?
There was a couple of old ones, one cylinder engines there, which is low compression one cylinder engines, and which were common to operations like the cannery. I remember seeing belt drive machinery. Everything, there was a belt salt to everything, and lots of sawdust around that area. So now you can't identify it, but it was sawdust, and now it all looks like dirt. But at that whole area is a lot of sawdust. And there you go, knowing the history of an area and then comparing that with what exists today and then knowing what might be in there.
What happened to the ruins? Did they move the machinery out or did it just collapse in place?
Snow load collapses happens a lot of buildings around here if they're not kept up. Some years you get a big snow load and it's enough to take buildings.
And so was it eventually removed?
It was cleared off, and then somebody decided it was a good building site, and that's where the Blue House is now. The Blue House sits exactly where the old sawmill sat.
And whose house is that?
Elsoss's.
Okay. Fred?
No, Pete, he died, and so it's his Lillian Alsos owns it now.
Okay.
And Fred's right up here. Pete's over, had the blue one, Pete and Lillian. But, you know, it's interesting to me. I would have liked to have seen the logs being floated up to the, you know, because obviously if you look up there now, not in this map, but, you know, and this one here would show it. Well, this little bite here is much more than what it shows here, but obviously they would have tied the logs up right in that little area, and that would have been the sawmill, and this would be log storage, and then pull them up one at a time up into the mill to the saw. But the significance here is we lost some beach. Here, see, this is all. This stuff was filled in, and here, this was all filled in, here and through here. But we gained flat land and we gained roadways. Like I said, in the early 1960s, there was no place you could play baseball in Soldovia on the 4th of July. And I remember one time we did have a baseball game right up in this area right here.
Did you witness the cemetery moving?
No, but I know. Actually, I could introduce you to a fellow that I think he participated in it. You might want to talk to him.
Who would that be?
I think Eddie Boone did it. Okay. But I'll have to ask him first because he may or may not want to. Uh-huh. And it's better I ask him before.
Sure.
Before, instead of you asking him.
Sure.
Because I know a couple of guys that worked on it that it was a little, they said it was a little spooky. You know, it's not their ordinary occupation. And
it's mine.
There you go. Yeah, they moved that. That was from down in this area. The old, where all the ones that got moved up to the graveyard came from down in here. And this is all boat storage here. Well, that's what this was.
So where the boat storage starts, is that where the cemetery used to be?
No, this was a raised boardwalk across here. Well, part of it wasn't too high here, but up on this end it was raised a bit to start up the hill. And this was lowlands all through here. And I think the graves were in here somewhere. Right? Uh-huh. It's Eddie, the ones who did it would remember. Because they actually spent time doing it. And it's just like this doesn't show it, but this is all way up on top of a hill right here. And this house is still here. And a couple of these are gone. In fact, almost all of this is gone now. These two up here, they were Quonsets.
They were Quonset huts up.
Yeah, see, you can almost see by the shape. This was a Quonset and this was a Quonset.
Huh. What was their history? Do you have any idea? What were they
being? Well, all the Quonsets came from Red Mountain. And Red Mountain was 1941 when they, Red Mountain was a standby emergency supply of chrome ore for a World War II effort, if needed.
Was there a mine there, actually?
Yes.
Yeah.
They did have a mine shaft, they had all the Quonsets were up there, and they had a certain amount of employees, and they were proceeding to take ore out. The idea being, Rommel was going across Africa and trying to close off the Suez Canal. And all the chrome ore at the time came out of Kenya. And the chrome was necessary to produce the higher, like the fighter engines and part of the bearings and things were coated. There's a certain amount of chrome to get those higher horsepower engines, which eventually, we developed stronger and better fighter planes as the war went on. But Without that, at that time, all the chrome ore did come from Africa. So they knew there was chrome here, and there's actually another one down at the end of the peninsula. It's at a place called Chrome Bay, which is down by off of Portlock. But this was the better source. So they were ready to go.
Let's jump to urban renewal, the actual process of it. And I know that the fellow who's in charge of that here, Lou
Collier.
I hope to talk with him. But what was it like when they were actually doing they used bulldozers, and did they use bulldozers on Caps Hill and heavy equipment?
Dynamite and bulldozers.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really. I think at that time I was still partly involved with the folks up in the homestead. And I remember I brought my mother down here, I think, in 64, my mother and stepfather, and they stayed here for 2 years. And I don't know why, but I don't have much recollection of the actual movement of the rock, though I did remember the buildings being torn down, because that that did bother me, because it I had some sense of appreciation for what was here. And to this day, there's nothing replaces this building here. And there's nothing replaces what was in, down in this cannery complex. They had a wood shop, a welding shop, a machine shop. They're not here anymore.
So those
functions.
All that
equipment and machine is gone.
Uh-huh.
And so what you got is you got a more modern place, but you don't have the self-sufficiency that this place used to have. You could do in Seldovia. I had had a better hardware store than any place in Cook Inlet, including Homer and Kenai. Better hardware store right here in Seldovia. And they had two machine shops. Each cannery had their own little machine shop, and they could fabricate stuff and make stuff. And they had their wood shop, and they could repair a boat, take planks or barges and maintain them and repair them. And they had wood storage. They had everything that they needed to be self-sufficient and self-reliant. And so when they lost those things, you can no longer get a bearing drilled in Seldovia. You can no longer go to a place like this and stretch your net out in February and March and work on your net, which you could then. If you were part of that cannery, you fish for that cannery, you could go there in the middle of winter, work on and just pull your net off a pile and stretch it out and mend it, and shape it, and whatever. So that, to me, that was a significant loss. These large warehouses and buildings were very, very much an asset. I'm trying to look here and figure out, because I remember one place you used to walk down past the cannery, and in the if it was in the winter time, boy, it was scary, because if that roof, the snow ever come off that roof while it'd be like going past avalanche country.
What happened to the buildings? Did they just burn them, the wood, or did they salvage? Was any of the wood salvaged by the community?
Well, mostly they used machinery to take stuff apart, and at first they let people get some stuff, and then it got to be too much of a. Right away, the guy was in charge. By the time I was out of town for a little while, when I came to town, and I asked him, when are you going to do this building or that building? Well, they wouldn't turn it loose, and they wouldn't let people in, because they. People ended up arguing. And I remember one place, the store, and I was going in there to get a sink, and somebody had a bathtub they were taking out of the second story, and somebody down below was yelling at them, "Hey, careful with that thing, you know, God dang." I mean, they're shoving a whole bathtub on the second story window, door, window, I think it was, you know. I remember one building in this area down here, this fact, it was the old... it was the old hardware store building, and I got some of the planks out of there, and I went in, and these guys had They were going to take the flooring. There was good planks in the flooring. And the welder at the time, his name was Merle Berger, and he welded together about a 5 foot long, 5.5 foot long bar with two round plated pliers on it. And you could put that underneath a plank, an inch and a half, 2 inch plank, and you could pull spikes out. That was designed just for her taking these old buildings apart when we were allowed to. And there was a couple of cases where they did that. Studnick, I think, was the contractor. And he was pretty good to let stuff go. But there was a couple of, as I said, there was the incident in the grocery store and that, where it was just, you get too many people. And, you know, one guy wants, everybody wants the window, or everybody wants the sink, and so he just stopped that. And I did get one building from him way down at the end, which was just plain boards, and he let me have that one. But he said, don't tell anybody, don't advertise it. And he said, you got so many hours tonight, he just, whatever you can get done tonight, tomorrow we're tearing it down. I don't want you anywhere near it. So I went there and I worked into the dark and got some planks and stuff. And a couple of people came by. That was way over by this side, by the church. And one lady that I had known, and she said, what are you doing? Who told you you could do that, you know? Because she knew the people who originally built the property, etc. And I said, I asked for permission. Well, I don't think you should. Well, the next day the bulldozer arrived, so I did. You know, there was a certain amount of that. So the contractor allowed as much as he could to get stuff salvaged, but if whenever it was going to cause him a problem, he just simply said, nobody gets in. So that's it. So the some of the old timers would go to the dump all the time and salvage from there.
So they did haul it to the dump.
They have hauled it to the dump that is right there. Right in here is the city dump. After, like I said, this was the original dump.
At the confluence of those two,
Anderson
and Winifred. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That was
then. I can't remember, right around earthquake time, maybe the year, but anyway, the city dump, before earthquake, the city started, decided that this was where the dump should be.
Further up the slough on the west side.
Yeah, well, and by that time, the road, this road was already there.
What's the name of the road?
Beach Road is all we ever used to call it.
Uh-huh.
And it used to go out here. There used to be a guy, Calhoun, about 2 miles out of town. He had a sawmill. He had trees, he cut trees, and had a sawmill out there, Red Calhoun. He moved to Homer just about earthquake time, just after the earthquake. Said his whole family moved over there.
I read in the book here that Susan Woodward Springer wrote that the urban renewal period, a lot of old families left Saldovia.
Yeah.
Some. When you first got here, in those 3 or 4 years before the quake, who were the old timers here? Who were the characters that inhabited Saldovia? Can you?
I've had people ask me, you know, what did you like about Saldovia? Why did you stay there? And then you could come here and get a job, you know, and you could, if you were willing to work, that's all that was required, that you were willing to work. And you could get a job, and you could, if you get a good reputation and you wanted to go on a boat, you could get on certain boats. But, you know, and the more long you were here, the better the boat, the better the season, etc. But the thing that attracted me to Saldovia, aside from the jobs, was the character of the old-timers. They were cosmopolitan. There were people who had been all around the world. They weren't end of the road, never been anywhere people. The people that were in this town who were sailors had been before the mast all over the world. Ouch, I'm getting a cramp. Yep.
Here. Well, but before we get into that, you were saying the old timers here were really cosmopolitan, and that was one of the things that attracted you.
What I liked about it is that I'm going to stretch my leg out there.
Yeah,
it was they were sailors, but they were very genuine people, and that's not a good word. But they'd been around. They had an open mind, and they were they made their own judgments, and they lived here by choice. You know, a couple of them old guys. Standard answer. You'd ask an old guy, well, of all the places in the world, you've been to Tahiti, you know, you've been to Hawaii, you've been to southern France, you've been to Greece, Spain. Why did you end up in Seldovia? And they just smile and say, well, the tide's out, the table's set, which means you never need to starve if you live on coastal Alaska, if you have any knowledge of what's available. But it was just an attitude, and I've seen some guys up at Talkeetna that I liked that were similar. They were miners, and they lived their own individual lives, and they had a lot of colorful history, but they chose to live there. And Seldovia had quite a few that were like that, and it's just where they chose. They arrived here and decided this is where they were going to stay.
Can you talk about anybody specifically, any names or any people in particular you really enjoyed?
Well, I liked Mr. Pilsk. Nels Pilskog was one of the nice people that I liked. I'm trying to think of his name.
Wait. Why did you like him?
Because he was not. He was honest, hardworking, friendly, helpful, a good person to have as a neighbor and as somebody to get to know, and having some people like that in the neighborhood, you just were amongst nice people.
Mm-hmm. And I interrupted you. You were saying another person down.
I was trying to think of. I used to have this house on. And then, boy, for my mind is just slipping right up on the hill corner here. No, this one right here, and it's still here. It's that. It's a little. It used to be yellow. Jerry Patrick owns it now. Of course, Jerry Patrick has a house right down in here, and none of that. So this is all built up. But at any rate, this one, I can't think of his name, but it was an Englishman, an English-type person, descent. And right up on top of this hill right here, there was a little, Fred had it, there was a little shack, and there was two brothers in there, and I can't think of their name right now. And at any rate, there wasn't just four or five or six or seven. It seemed to me, I would say over a dozen of those type of gentlemen like that had the background, that had been around.
You mentioned earlier today Mad Trapper Kroll.
Yeah.
Who was he?
Henry Kroll, Sr. He was known as the Mad Trapper. And he started out in the Cordova area. And he used to have a small plane, and he'd fly over the city of Cordova and play a violin. And then he didn't like one bartender, so he went into his bar and shook a Wolverine out of a bag loose in the bar. And another time, when the 4th of July or something, he had a Wolverine on a line in front of him. And I think, though I don't know all the details of it, I think he had a chain and rattled it. At any rate, the Wolverine respected him and didn't turn around to attack him. And if you know anything about Wolverines, for somebody to have get a hold of one and master one was really significant. But even with the old trappers and them, you know, the mountain men of Montana and Idaho, that Wolverine was a nasty character. So, mad trapper, because he did mad things, but he did all. He did anything and everything he wanted to, and was capable of doing anything and everything. If he wanted a fish sight, he'd go and get a fish sight. And if he wanted a boat that would go take more punishment and harder than anybody, he'd build it himself, and he built it stronger. And if he wanted to some lumber to build his boat or to build his house on the other side of the inlet, he'd start up his own sawmill. And he did just everything. And he went gold mining and built a reputation for himself. That's why it was originally started out as a mad trapper, and the Wolverines got him the title of being mad.
You mentioned also Luke Fisher.
Yeah.
Who is he?
He owned the Saluvia Hotel, and that's another one you could check if you talk to. And I see Lou is back. He must have got off the ferry today, Lou Collier. He was a character, and there was, and I think of it now, easily a dozen to 20. If you depend on somewhere, you might say by Saldovia standards, 12 of them were real characters, but by anywhere else standards, 20 or more would have been characters. And what I liked about it is this town wasn't bigoted or hypocritical, in my opinion. These guys were here, and they had a worldly attitude. And they make a judgment. If they accepted you, you had a carte blanche acceptance. You know, they were very generous and friendly. I found them friendly. I liked that. And a certain amount of, imagine any of these coastal towns, you will find that. Even in Vancouver, Canada, I found some, but Saldovia had a concentration. And you talk to certain people, and even ask Mr. Collier, why did you end it in Saldovia? At that time, you'd ask different ones. And I think Steve Zawistowski, and he lived on Main Street, was a fisherman. And his story was that he was on a boat and had gone all the way down the chain and back and around and come to Saldovia, and he just signed off the boat, got off the boat, I'm going to stay here. And this was in the 1930s. Some of these guys came here, you know, quite a few of them. And of course, the other thing during the Depression days, well, people came up here and worked, the Norwegians, and set up the herring industry, and they could be self-employed, make some money, make a life for themselves, and, you know, instead of sitting around having no jobs or nothing. So this was a very active area in the 20s and 30s. And they say there was way, way more population on Kachemak Bay all the way to Seward. At the time that they were running the herring and the fox farms, the one overlapped the other. And at that time, there was more people, a resident, and you know, it was the height of the Depression in the lower 48, but up here, people could work. And so they, you know, they had a contented existence.
I've got a specific question. If you know where we're at here in this house, and it's by the way, we're in the Bridge Keepers B&B here, right by the bridge across the slough.
Right.
And just to the west here, there's a little red cabin with a school bus in the yard, just right there.
Right.
What's the history of that place? Do you know?
Oh. What you don't know is this road goes through Dora Urson's house and yard. And the amount of houses that existed here... There was one, two, three houses that came out in order for this road to be corrected when the bridge was, the new bridge, when they changed the road design and then they put the bridge in. And in order to change the road design and put this bridge in and approaches, the Herson property was taken, and only that little red shed was just a little red house was something she had built on the back of her property. I don't remember if she used it as a rental or what. But
what was her name again?
Dora, D-O-R-A. Oh, I got to block it.
Sure. Got it.
U-R-S-I.
Okay, yeah, so Dora Herson, and she had a house and it was condemned for the bridge construction?
Yeah, what they call condemned, or they take it over the property.
Yeah.
And there was three houses. And if you go down here, just by the corner, you'll see that there's a fire hydrant. And the fire hydrant used to be on the corner, and it's the road used to be the other side of the fire hydrant. So down where all those alders are was where the old road was. So up here, it took out Urson's property. It took out Dorothy Parker's property. Okay, this is Urson's big yard here. This house, there was another house here at the, and that's long gone. It was torn, not long gone, but that was taken down way after the earthquake. And then this is Urson's right here. And apparently this actually 59. Wow, that little shed there was the real original bridge keeper, yeah, right there.
So there was actually a bridge keeper.
There was actually a bridge keeper, and there was a little wee shed. You can see the size of it compared to, see that, just that little dot. It was real small. And this is Dora Urson's, and the present, and the little red. Okay, up here. Oh, you can hardly see her cabin. This is Alice Nutbeam. And then that little cabin is right underneath this pen. And that's Dora Urson's house. So the road went, the present, this is the old road. And the present road goes right through here and then makes a sweep.
Mm-hmm. And
so Dorothy Parker had this, and she run a restaurant. She had this one. And David Swenson owned this one. And so that's... the road is so much different now. It comes up here and then it goes like right through there.
And the school bus, did you know anything about how the school bus ended up there?
Oh, that old bus, Jerry Willard bought it from somebody. And he wanted something from Nick, and Nick Elksnick. And Nick Elksnick died here about, there's a bench down in front of the Harbor Master, gives his date of birth as being about 1903, and he died in, 98 or 99 or something like that. He was in his 90s. I think he was around 97 years old. But anyway, Nick's thing is, Nick Elks, Nick was one of the old timers here, and... I'm trying to recall. What was your question again?
Something about the bus. How Jerry Willard got
the green bus. Well, Jerry got it. So people would come here. Those old buses were a means of getting to Alaska. Just like home, some of the first people come here would bring a little trailer. Because then they knew they'd have a place to live while they were building their homes or log houses or whatever. And you could buy 20-foot trailers in the lower 48, old trailers for a pretty reasonable price. Still can. And what? At any rate, that old bus came here, and whoever brought it here, Jerry Willard would, at any rate, it was not abandoned, but Jerry acquired it for a storage thing. And he used it for a while, because he never has enough storage, like a lot of Seldovians are acquirers. Anyway, and Nick needed it, and Jerry sold it to Nick. It actually got drove up to where it is. Droven up there, and that had to be, boy, I would guess in the late 70s. Because I remember the bus. I remember when Jerry had it.
And Jerry's the person that lives in the old hospital, is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Willard. Jerry Willard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got another question I'd like to jump to. You said that you were a bartender here for a while?
Yeah, for 1 year I bartended.
Where at?
It was known as a night spot. K-N-I-G-H-T. And that was because the Knight brothers owned it. And Chuck Knight also owned the grocery store.
And what was it like being a bartender there?
I was 39 when I started bartending, 38 or 39, educational. Different outlook. You learn to evaluate people differently and appreciate and evaluate. Or in some cases, depreciate. Mm-hmm. But a different way of looking at people. At that time, we had the loggers and the fishermen. And the loggers were, the logging was pretty strongly, going strong at that time, and the fishing was still going strong, so there was two separate economies. The fishing had dropped off a little. Depend on when you compare the two. So that was 70 or 71, I think it was 71 when I was bartending. Yeah, they both the fishing was going strong and the logging was going strong. And I knew people from both areas and got along fine. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any phone, couldn't call the police. So he had to handle the problems. He had problems, he had to handle them. Diplomacy is the first educational thing. Learn diplomacy. That's much better than any other choice.
Yeah. Okay, I have one more thing. In the back of Susan Springer's book here, she's got a list of old buildings. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but I wonder if you could comment on them. The Seldovia Bible Chapel, built in 1944, strongest concrete in town. Are you familiar with that building?
I know Mr. Tobelman. My wife and I were married. Tobelman. I knew Mr. Tobelman. No, we weren't married by Tobelman. We were married. I'm trying to think of the other guy's name. Tobelman was a tall, thin man. So Tobelman built it. Oh, be darned. Okay, yeah. Of course, that came in 1960, and it's still there. It has had quite a few additions to it. But the basic Bible chapel building is still there. It's had quite a few changes and expansions. But the property, it's the same location. Buckman's home, that was the one that I mentioned down here that is one of the bigger ones from left over from the original Seldovia.
On the far north end of town.
Yeah. The old city cemetery, Seward End. Main Street.
An outgrowth of the original Orthodox cemetery, it says, and was not moved.
Oh, okay. It's a little patch up on the hillside there, yeah. It's a small patch, and I think it's got a wire fence around.
Yeah. Whereabouts? Does it show up on this map?
Let's see. Remember I said that big building that's right up the city dock now is right about here.
You know what? Let's mark these on a different map, and we can just write right on it. Which map should we use? 1996 or 1959? Aerial photo, I mean. Should we use the 59 or 96?
I kind of like this because it's easy to write on. But
sure. Let's do that.
Yeah, and then again, oh boy, because this has got the, there again, I have the trouble locating.
It's